conversations with a lot of you over the past couple of days. So yeah, as Gus said, I'm a grad student at MIT where I work with Eddie Farhi. And today I'm going to be telling you about the quantum adversary upper bound, which is a tool or a technique that can be used to help find and design new quantum algorithms. And I hope you'll feel free to ask questions as they come up. I'm not sure what everyone's background is in quantum algorithms or whatnot. So please ask me questions if you're not clear. And can you all hear me okay? Okay. So within the field of quantum computing, designing new quantum algorithms is one of the major thrusts. But this is kind of a two-part goal. So in one sense, it's a very practical goal. We're hoping that in the not too distant future, we're going to have a working quantum computer. And when that day comes, we want to have a library, you know, set up, filled with algorithms that we can plug into our quantum computer and start to see some of the speed ups that we've been researching and hearing about and that we think we can get from a quantum computer. But the second goal of designing quantum algorithms is that it's a more kind of fundamental or a theoretic goal, and that's that every time we design a new quantum algorithm, we learn something new about the power of quantum mechanics. So we learn something new about how quantum mechanics can be used for computation, about how quantum mechanics is different from classical computing. And there's two kind of big questions, things like what problems are most natural to be solved on a quantum computer, and what is really the origin of quantum speedups versus classical speedups. These kinds of questions we don't completely understand. And when we design new quantum algorithms, it gives us insight into these more fundamental questions. So in this talk, it'll kind of address quantum algorithms from these two perspectives. So first of all, we're going to try and design a quantum algorithm that hopefully has some use. But more importantly, we're going to try and look at the structure of quantum algorithms and try and learn something more fundamental about quantum algorithms and see if we can use that to help us design quantum algorithms. So we're going to look and see if there's something more fundamental about the structure of quantum algorithms that we can use. So that's exactly what I'm going to be talking about today. The result I'm going to be telling you about is that we're going to use some knowledge, some fact about the structure of quantum algorithms. We're going to combine this fact together with some non-optimal quantum algorithm. By using these two things together, we're going to be able to prove the existence of an optimal quantum algorithm. So we're really going to leverage our knowledge of how quantum algorithms should behave to help us design new quantum algorithms. And we're going to do it using this thing, this quantum adversary upper bound from the title, this tool that lets us kind of can help us guide us towards new quantum algorithms. So this is the result that I'm going to be discussing. So how are we going to get there? I'm going to first introduce the Oracle model and query complexity, which some of you are very familiar with, but maybe some of you haven't seen. Then I'll introduce this tool, this quantum adversary upper bound, in more detail. And then we're going to apply it. So as I said, we're going to use it to prove the existence of an optimal quantum algorithm. But it has this funny property. It's kind of a non-constructive tool. So we're going to prove the existence of an algorithm, but then we don't actually have the algorithm. We know it must exist. So then we're also going to go out and find an explicit algorithm that this quantum adversary upper bound tells us exists, but we still need to find it. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Are there any questions so far on kind of the basic motivation? OK. So just a little bit of background. So the quantum Oracle model, we assume that we have some function f, and f is completely known. And for now we'll say f is Boolean. So f has a bunch of inputs, x1 through xn. So those inputs are Boolean variables. They take value either 0 or 1. And the output of f is also 0 or 1. And so we know f. Maybe it's asking, are a majority of the inputs, do a majority of the inputs have value 1? Or it could be, do any of the inputs have value 1? Or it could be parity, are there an even number of the inputs that have value 1? Some question like this. But we know what f is. What we don't know are these inputs, x1 through xn. So to access these inputs, we're given something called an oracle. So an oracle is a black box function. And you give it an index, I, and it tells you the value of the x sub ith input. So classically, we can do this. We literally have a box where we give it a value I, and it spits out the value of x sub I. But quantum mechanically, that such type of a box is not reversible. So if you want to have this tied up to a quantum computer, if you want to have your oracle tied to a quantum computer, you need it to be reversible. So now the oracle has two registers, one where you put in the index that you want to learn, and one that's just a register that's going to store the output. But the quantum oracle it gives you the same information as the classical oracle, but now it can be queried in quantum superposition. So our goal is to, with high probability, output the correct answer to F given such an oracle, and also, a full working quantum computer that we can attach this oracle to. And what we're going to keep track of is we're going to keep track of the number of uses of this oracle. So often what we'd like to keep track of is something like the time that it takes to compute F, or the size of the computer we need to compute F. But it turns out that it's often easier to keep track of this oracle instead. So this oracle, to keep track of the number of uses of this oracle. So what we're going to keep track of is just how many times we use this black box. We're not going to keep track of time or space. And we're going to call the number of uses of this oracle Q of F. So it's kind of a stand-in for things that we maybe care more about, like time and space, but it's easier to calculate things about this query complexity Q of F. Any questions about query complexity? Okay. So how do we go about calculating what the query complexity is? Normally, we care about how the query complexity scales as we increase the size of the problem. So the way we calculate query complexity is we generally try and upper bound it. And we upper bound it by creating an algorithm. So you just lay out your algorithm, and you show your algorithm works, and you show that the algorithm uses the oracle so many times. Maybe it's not the best algorithm. Maybe there's another algorithm that exists that could use the oracle fewer times. But at least any algorithm that you can create gives you an upper bound on the query complexity, on the number of times you need to use that black box oracle. So that gives us an upper bound on query complexity. Then there are these really beautiful techniques, like the quantum adversary bound and the polynomial method, that allow us to lower bound query complexity. And I'm not going to go too much into detail of these methods, but the idea is you keep trying to create better and better algorithms. You keep trying to improve your lower bound methods, and then eventually these two bounds meet, and that at that point you have an exact value for query complexity. So that's generally the strategy that people use for computing the query complexity of some function. So what's going to be a little bit different about this talk is that we're going to be creating an upper bound on query complexity, again, without creating an algorithm. So we're going to use this tool, this quantum adversary upper bound, to upper bound query complexity, but without an algorithm, because it's non-constructive. OK, this is basically just a notation slide. We're going to think about these functions kind of graphically sometimes. So here again, we have our known function f. We have a bunch of inputs that are, you can get the information about them from the oracle. And we want to know the output. There's nothing quantum here. This is just a representation of the function. And then we're often going to be considering composed functions. So f raised to the k power means f composed k times. So now we have this function f. There are k levels. And the outputs of f at one level just become the inputs to f at the next level. So we're going to see kind of, during the talk, we're going to see more graphical representations of functions that kind of look like this. OK, so at this point, that's pretty much the background we need. Still no questions? OK. So now I can just, at this point, I can state this result, this quantum adversary upper bound. So we need a function f to be a Boolean function. And now what we care about is f. We want to learn something about the query complexity for f. But what we're going to start with is an algorithm for f composed k times. So we assume we create some algorithm for f composed k times, and say that algorithm uses t queries. So as I've said, whenever we have an algorithm, that gives an upper bound on query complexity. So we know that the query complexity of f compose k times is upper bounded by t. So then what the quantum adversary upper bound tells us is that the query complexity of f is then upper bounded by t to the 1 over k. It doesn't tell us what algorithm gives us that bound. It just tells us that once you have this algorithm for f compose k times, you can immediately learn something about just f on its own. So this result is a little bit surprising. So I mean, I've kind of been harping on this, but it doesn't give an algorithm for f. It just tells you that one with a certain query complexity must exist. But this result is, I think, surprising for a second reason. And it's surprising that it's ever useful. So why might we expect that this result is just never going to be useful? Well, think about how we're going to use it. The first thing we need is an algorithm for f compose k times, right? So how are you going to get that? Well, probably you're going to first just create an algorithm for f. And maybe you create your algorithm for f, and it uses t queries. Then you're just going to apply that algorithm many times to get this composed algorithm. And you might expect that this composed algorithm, when you look at it, has a number of queries that scales like t to the k. And then if you try and apply this quantum adversary upper bound, you end up just right back where you started, that the query complexity of f is upper bounded by t. So whenever you have a situation like this, you learn, you know, nothing from this quantum adversary upper bound. But it turns out that if you don't have if your original algorithm for f is kind of suboptimal, maybe suboptimal in a specific way, then the quantum adversary bound can give you some information. Okay, so we're going to look now at, we're going to try and apply this to an example where this doesn't happen, where the quantum adversary upper bound actually gives you new information about query complexity. Still no questions. I hope that doesn't mean you're all lost. Okay. So the function we're going to look at is something called the one-fault NAND tree. So this is a variant of the NAND tree, which is a pretty common function in classical and quantum computing. So the NAND function stands for not AND. So I've put the truth table up on the right. It's just a 2-bit function, and its output is 0 only when both of the inputs are 1. And so now you can just compose this NAND function, you know, with itself. And you want to know, given some input of zeros and ones down at the bottom, what is the value at the top, where you just successively take the NANDs at each level. So this is the general NAND tree, but we're going to consider a variant of this called the one-fault NAND tree. So what is that? So here I've actually gone through and just evaluated the full NAND tree. So every node I've taken, you know, the NAND of the two values below it and calculated the NAND. So in this case, the output of this tree is 0. But I've circled certain nodes here, and I've said that they're false. So what does that mean? If you notice, all of the nodes that are faults, if you look at their two children, which are the nodes directly below them, a fault has one child that's a 0 and one child that's a 1. And every other node in this tree, both of its children, both have the same value. So this one-fault NAND tree is basically a promise on what types of inputs are allowed. So we're not going to allow just any string of zeros and ones. We're going to promise that the oracle has a certain structure, a certain promise to it. And so our promise is going to be that if you were to go through and evaluate the whole tree like I've done here, that there are not going to be too many of these faults. And so in particular, if you take a path from the output down to one of the inputs, that you're only going to hit at most one fault. So a fault has one child that's 0 and one child that's 1. So you promise that the input is such that if you were to go through and evaluate the whole tree like this, it would have this kind of structure. So if you take a path, any path down here, you just hit one fault or no faults. So that's the promise on the input. Yeah.
So the zero fault tree would then just have everything at the same level be equal?
Mm-hmm. You would just alternate a level of zeros, a level of ones, so you can see these faults somehow add complexity to the tree. Because if there are no faults, you can just, you know, look at a single input. If it's 0, you just kind of alternate levels back up to the top, and you can immediately learn the value of the output. So somehow this is what's adding structure to the tree and complicating it. Yes?
Is there a relationship between the number of faults and, if you look at the string on the bottom, the number of transitions between 0 and 1? You go from left to right?
Yes. So if you look at all of the nodes descending from a fault, so like if that fault up here, all of the inputs from here over, you see that the first half always has the same value and the second half always has the same value. And that's the same here. But we kind of don't know the total number of splits because these faults could have happened higher up. Like we could have just had one fault way up at the top and then we would have just had two big blocks instead of one big block and four little blocks. Did that answer your question?
Well, you've got five faults on that example.
Or four faults?
Counting the number of transitions, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Maybe that's just a coincidence.
Yeah, no. That's not quite. We're towards the end of the talk, we're going to discuss the relationship between faults and the inputs a little bit more.
Four faults.
But here, you know, if this were flipped, then you would have an extra transition here. You know, there could be a transition here if this was a zero and this was a.
You have one last next.
But these two could be flipped too.
No.
Anyway, it's something like that, but it's not critical for us. Yes.
So I'm having a bit of difficulty understanding this one fault tree.
Sure.
And it comes from two different features, and hopefully you can help me understand better. The first is, I assume that you're not doing sort of generic ruling function evaluation. In other words, these faults, who determines where they sit? What they do.
Yeah, so that's the mystery. We know that there aren't that many faults, but we don't know where they sit. If we knew where they sit, you know, we're given an oracle for these things down at the bottom. You know, these guys down here are what we can measure. And just looking at one of them, that doesn't tell you very much about where a fault might be. But once you knew all the locations of the fault, it would be, you know, easy to figure out what, or even if you knew the location of one fault, you could figure out the value of the output. But because you don't know where they are, that's.
I guess the other part of the question is, what are you trying to do? And what is the problem that this solves?
Right,
what's the underlying computation whose answer you're trying to find the answer to in this particular structure? I mean, is it the unfaulted output of the NAND tree?
We're trying to figure out, so at the top there's the zero at the very top of the tree, right? So I mean, literally, we're trying to find out what that value is.
The string is not faulty, right?
Why is it
standard every step?
Yeah, why is it? Why are they called false?
Because you used to have the structure, right? This 0101 structure, and then you put in this fault, and it kind of.
It's always the same function,
yes.
But
not
at some point two inputs are different, unless you
yes.
declare faulty, yeah. but the circuit's not faulty.
But
right?
I mean, I can also rewrite that
it's
as just another Boolean function, right?
It's all NANDs, right? The whole circuit consists only of NANDs, right?
Yeah.
There are no faulty gates or anything like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, but no mistakes, right?
No mistakes.
I think
but
the naming
fault,
is maybe
fault
a bit
is in the geological sense. that was a good point.
Yeah.
We're trying to evaluate this tree, we're trying to figure out the output, but we're just promised that you know not every possible set of zeros and ones is allowed as an input. Only certain sets of sequences of zeros and ones are going to be allowed here, and those are the ones that have this structure. So the fault is about the structure of the tree, not about making a mistake.
Okay, I mean, it seems to me that is just a different Boolean function rather than NAND, but maybe I misunderstand or something. I don't understand.
You're saying it's all NAND, but there's an overwrite that occurs. Is that correct?
Yeah, you're promised there's a limit. You're promised something about the input.
It's a Boolean function. So why can't I just...
There's no overwriting. So you're thinking fault means mistake.
But that's not true.
Yeah.
Fault is just a description of a pattern of zero and ones that occurs for a certain input. So certain inputs, like the all zero input, will, you know, when you look at any level, you'll see no transition between zero and ones. And you can say, in the geological sense, this looks smooth. There are no faults. But in other patterns, you see these transitions between zero and ones, and you just call those faults.
You're just guaranteeing that of all the inputs, we restrict ourselves to the ones which give a certain number of faults.
Yes.
Okay.
Property of the oracle, then?
Yes.
Taking advantage?
Yes.
I see.
Okay, so can I try and clarify this? The oracle holds your input and you query your, you get one of the input bits by querying the oracle.
Yes.
But you're promised that the oracle hides an input bit that only has a bounded number of faults when you evaluate
yes.
it.
Yes. That's right. So there's an implicit promise in the oracle.
Yeah.
And so in some sense, there's the degeneracy of inputs that you're over evaluating with this NAND. With pure NAND, you're over evaluating.
Yeah. Right.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. Well, that helped.
No, this is important. This is key because, yeah. So the next thing I'm going to talk about is like, what does this mean? This seems like a very contrived function, but is there any kind of, does this function mean anything? Is there any reason why I would want to compute this function? Okay. So maybe that'll help motivate this a little bit. So. Maybe some of you are familiar with the fact that a NAND tree can be thought of as a game tree. So this is a generalization. You have a two-player game, like chess or checkers. And you want to know, is there a strategy that would always allow one player to win? So it turns out that the NAND tree is a kind of very simplified model for this. So you can think of this NAND tree as a game. So in the game, I'm playing against one other person. And I start at the top, up at the output. And I can choose to go right or left. So maybe I choose to go right. Maybe my opponent chooses to go left. Let's see. So I choose to go right. So I'm over here. My opponent chooses to go left. Maybe I choose to go right. My opponent chooses to go left. And then whatever we get, the value of this node down at the bottom that we end up at tells us who's won the game. So in this case, we ended up at a zero. That means I've lost. So it turns out that if you take, so all of these inputs down here tell you the end games. They tell you who wins if you get to this point in the tree. And then what this output up here tells you, if you were to evaluate this NAND tree, this output tells you which player would win if both players play optimally. So in this case, you know, my opponent played optimally, and she won. And we can see that because the output of the tree is a zero. So that means that as long as my opponent's playing optimally, I'm going to lose. OK, so that's true for any NAND tree. So now what is this? If we have this fault condition, what kind of a game tree do we have now? So basically, this new tree encodes a game that you're promised that there's only going to be one decision point in the game. So you can be playing with your opponent, but you can basically not even, it doesn't matter where you move for most of the game. Except there's going to be this one decision point where one of you is going to have to make a critical decision, and that's going to determine who wins the game. So it's a very simple game. You don't know when that decision point is going to happen, but you're promised that there's just going to be this one time. So one can imagine that there could be some kind of game like this, and you'd like to know who's going to win this game. And then if you were to evaluate this tree, that would tell you who's going to win such a game if both players play optimally. Yeah, I mean, if you end up at most one decision point, so you could go down this path and never have to make a decision. But you know, if even though my opponent's gonna, you know, I know that if she plays optimally, she's gonna win. I probably am gonna try and direct us away from the path where we don't have to make a decision. I try to force her to make a decision so that she might make the wrong decision.
That's if there's at most one fault per path,
right.
Then you have that. So if there's like at most k faults per path, then presumably there's k critical decision points.
Exactly. And we will see that soon. So. Okay, so any questions about this setup, about the one fault NAND tree, about what it means, what faults mean?
What is this an example of?
So remember, we're trying to evaluate this function. We're given an oracle. Is this what you're asking? What's the big picture? So we're given an oracle, and we want to know how many times we're given an oracle for these inputs down at the bottom, and we want to know how many times do we need to look at that oracle or use that oracle in order to be able to determine the value of this node up here. Yeah, we want to compute the query complexity of evaluating this function, yes, with this promise of the one fault condition. Yeah.
So just out of curiosity,
yeah,
did you set out trying to solve this problem, or is this more a case of kind of drawing a target around where the arrow fell?
Yeah, so we set out, so what we were really interested in, well, the reason I and some collaborators were looking at this problem was we were hoping to see if using, so the normally the NAND tree without this restriction doesn't give you any kind, it only gives you a polynomial speedup between a classical and quantum query complexity. But we were curious if you take just some kind of function that has only a polynomial speedup, if you can, by restricting the inputs to that function, if you can turn that polynomial speedup into a superpolynomial speedup. So that was the original reason we were looking at these types of trees. And it, you can, actually.
So you can sort of improve over the polynomial speedup?
Actually, not with a one. Well, you can. Maybe. Well, we're going to get to this in like two slides. So maybe I'll just move on. So this is what I was talking about, these types of trees I was studying with Boajan and Avinatan Hasidim. And so we were trying to find this super polynomial speedup. And so what we looked at, we were looking at k-fault trees. So just like Gus said, these trees that now, instead of just one fault per path, now you're allowed to have k-faults per path. And we found this algorithm that has query complexity 2 to the k times the depth squared, where k is, you know, the maximum number of faults that you hit on any path. OK, so I'm just going to state that we have this algorithm, and then we'll see what happens. How does this algorithm do for different types of trees? So for a one-fault tree of depth d, we see that we get a query complexity of d squared, because k is 1, so it's just about the depth. Now what we're going to do is we're going to look at this original one-fault tree composed log d times. OK, so now when you go through this first level, you hit one fault. When you go through the second level, you hit at most one fault, and so on down through the tree. So this whole tree is a log d fault tree. OK? So we can just plug in log d into our formula, and we see that the query complexity of this now composed tree goes like d cubed. And it turns out that for this type of tree, you get a super polynomial speedup compared to that was what we originally showed, that for this type of tree, you get a super polynomial speedup. Okay, but if you notice something, if you look at how these scale, this is not scaling quite right. This is kind of precisely how, when we were talking about why this result might not be useful, you know, we had to have a certain scaling between the original function and the composed function. And here we actually don't have that same scaling at all. The scaling here is very different. So let's just try and apply this quantum adversary upper bound. So remember, it needs to be a Boolean function, which it is. The first thing we need to do is come up with an algorithm for the composed function. So we have an algorithm for the one-fault NAND tree, composed log d times, that uses d cubed queries. And then we just apply this result of the quantum adversary upper bound. It tells us that the quantum query complexity of just a single one-fault NAND tree is a constant. OK, so it turns out that actually a one-fault NAND tree, you know, is just as easy as a zero-fault NAND tree. The number of queries that you need to evaluate a one-fault NAND tree does not scale with the size of the system. So.
Many faults do you need? Using one fault NAND tree, you do not see any sort of, it's the same, it's a constant.
Right.
Compared to the no fault.
Right, so that means like you can increase the depth as much as you want, but as long as you have the promise that you're only going to hit one fault, there's no scaling with depth. Also, As long as k is a constant, we're going to see that there's no scaling. Yep. Yeah, that's exactly what we'll see. And so maybe I should say that, you know, we thought when we had come up with this depth, with this d squared query complexity for a, you know, one fault in the entry of depth d, we thought that was pretty good, because actually this is already an exponential improvement over the general NAND tree. So if you look at the query complexity of a NAND tree without any of these promises of faults, the query complexity scales as the square root of 2 to the depth. So already this is an exponential improvement, so we thought we had a pretty good algorithm. But it turns out that, in fact, you know, you can do better than this, and that there's an algorithm that just uses a constant number of queries.
And what's the classical complexity?
The classical complexity is log d, at least lower bounded by log d.
For one fault.
For one fault, yeah. OK, and just as you were mentioning, actually, for any, you know, c where c is a constant number of faults, the same result holds. So just you know you can plug things in, and you see that, again, for constant fault trees, you can just evaluate it using a constant number of queries. And again, you can imagine with a constant number of faults, things are looking pretty complicated. It's not a trivial tree, yet somehow, you know, a quantum algorithm can evaluate it very efficiently. And in fact, instead of NAND, you can replace, there are a whole family of functions that you could replace NAND with. And these are what we call direct functions. So direct functions are like a generalization of a monotonic function. So examples are a majority or not majority. And for the kind of characteristic of a monotonic function is that there's one input to the function x0 that has value 0, another input x1 that has value 1, and x0 and x1 differ at every single bit. And furthermore, any path, so if you go through and flip one bit, then flip another bit, and so travel from x0 to x1, we want the function to be monotonic on that path. So it should be 0, and then at some point you flip a bit and you go up to 1. So in this, when you have this more general function, it turns out that any of these inputs, like as long as the input is not x0 and not x1, that could be considered a fault. But x0 and x1 are not faults. So you can kind of construct similar conditions, construct k-fault, whatever function you choose in here, as long as it satisfies these properties. OK, so. Right. So now we know that these constant query algorithms exist. In just a little bit, we're going to try and find them. But just before I do that, I'm going to just briefly discuss how the proof of this result works. So it kind of results from two really powerful lemmas. The first is from Ben Reichart. And he showed that the quantum query complexity is asymptotically equal to the semi-definite program called the general adversary bound, or the negative weights adversary, which we denote this ADV plus or minus F. And so this was a really impressive result and really exciting, because it meant that instead of having to consider this whole, you know, you can think of so many different types of quantum algorithms that you might want to create to evaluate some function f. But this result tells you that you don't really need to do that. Instead, you could just solve the semi-definite program, and that would immediately tell you the query complexity of whatever function you care about. So somehow this very complex problem has just reduced to some semi-definite program. So that's really nice. But at the same time, it's not quite as nice as we would like, because to solve this semi-definite program it's an exponentially sized semi-definite program in the size of f, so it's not, you know, that easy to evaluate. And furthermore, we're mostly interested in how the query complexity scales as the size of f increases. Because we want to know, as the problem size gets really big, are we going to be able to solve some function faster on a quantum computer than a classical computer? But if you solve this semi-definite program for a function of a certain size, It just spits out a number. And then you solve it for, you know, the function of the next largest size, and it just spits out a number. And so you get a sequence of numbers, but that you can't prove anything about scaling that way, because maybe you're just looking in a regime where it happens to scale a certain way, but out asymptotically it scales differently. So to really, you know, prove something about how the scaling of a function goes, it's not so useful. But this is where, if we get back to the beginning of the talk, I said what we would really like to do is somehow understand the structure of quantum algorithms and use that to help us design better algorithms. So even though maybe using this semi-definite program directly is a little bit difficult, we can study properties of the semi-definite program and try and use the insight that we get from looking at these properties to help us design algorithms. So in particular, as you might have guessed, since we've been talking about composed functions, this semi-definite program has really nice properties under composition. So in particular, the one that we're going to be using is that the adversary bound of f composed k times is larger than the adversary bound of f raised to the kth power. And so this second result was shown by Hoyerly and Spalek for Boolean functions when there's no restriction on the inputs. But you know, we've been talking about this one fault NAND tree where it has this restriction on the inputs. So I showed that this still holds for partial functions. And then once you have these two lemmas, the proof is basically four lines of algebra. But you know, all of the power is in the two lemmas. So maybe I'll just, how are we doing on time? Okay. So I'll just maybe mention, so this is kind of the most technical result in the paper showing that, you know, this adversary bound of f composed k times is greater than that adversary bound of f raised to the kth power. So how would this work in the case of non-partial functions? So the idea is you're given a solution to the semi-definite program for just f. So you assume you're given some positive semi-definite matrix that satisfies the constraints of the program and maximizes the objective function. And given this matrix, you want to take that and construct a new positive semi-definite matrix that satisfies the constraints of the SDP for the big function, for f composed k times. So you want to take your original solution and somehow, you know, turn it into a new potential solution for the larger problem. And that, you know, that works fine in the case of total functions. But how might this break down a little bit when you have now partial functions? So partial is when you don't have every possible input. Only, you know, certain inputs are allowed. Like in our case, you know, only those inputs that gave the one fault condition. Okay, so you're given this original solution for the SDP for F, and that matrix encodes all the information about the partiality of F. It basically has to encode what inputs are valid. So that original matrix knows which inputs are valid to F. But now somehow you need to create this new solution for F composed. And this new solution, or potential solution, not only needs to know that, you know, you have to have a valid input here, you have to have a valid input here, but it also needs to keep track of the fact that the input up here at the second level must also be valid. So somehow it needs to learn something about a global constraint on all of the inputs. And it's not clear how, if you just have something that knows just about these inputs here, how is it going to be able to, how are you going to learn something about kind of the global constraints? So that's where things might break down. So it turns out it doesn't break down. So it turns out that you can kind of create these matrices where these positive semi-definite matrices that are the solutions for the SDP. It turns out that every element of the matrix is kind of associated with an input. And it turns out you can just set to zero all those elements that don't correspond to valid inputs. And it turns out that when you do this, you can kind of go through the normal proof, like for total functions, but just with a whole bunch of elements set to zero. And it turns out that everything kind of goes through OK. It's not very interesting, but it's pretty technical, checking that really things work out. But that's kind of the intuition. OK, so at this point, we're going to kind of switch to now trying to find algorithms, right? We've proved that they exist for all these constant fault direct trees, and now we want to create them. Any questions? Okay.
The query, what was the functional relationship between the query complexity and this function?
They're equal.
That theta there, what?
That means
asymptotically equal.
Okay.
Yeah. Right, so basically anything that we can learn about this semi-definite program just immediately tells us something about query complexity. They're basic, you can think of them as completely equivalent. But because the semi-definite program has this nice structure, it's kind of easier to work with in some way. Okay, right. So as I said, we want to try and find these matching constant query algorithms for constant fault direct trees. So, if you're familiar at all with quantum algorithms, you've probably heard of span programs. So span programs are basically the dual of this general adversary bound that I've been talking about. And so it's kind of not surprising that these span programs, which are themselves a semi-definite program, are going to give us the optimal solution. So what is a span program? So a span program is just a linear algebraic way of representing a Boolean function. So for every function, you can create a span program. And a span program just consists of a set of vectors. These vectors up here are called input vectors. So to each input, x1 can have two values, 0, 1. And so we give it two vectors, one that's associated with the 0 vector and one that's associated with the 1 vector, one that's associated with the 0 input and one that's associated with the 1 input. And we do this for, all of the inputs. Then we also have a target vector. So this set of vectors is a valid span program for our function f, if and only if you take the set of vectors here corresponding to a certain input. So say you have a string of zeros and ones. You take all of the vectors corresponding correctly to those zeros and ones, and you look at the span of those vectors. If the target vector is in the span of these input vectors, then the value of the function on that input should be 1. So it turns out that you can always create such a set of vectors for any function, any Boolean function. And in fact, you can create an infinite number of possible solutions. But what's kind of amazing is that given any set of vectors that satisfy this condition, you can create a quantum algorithm from them. So there's just a procedure that you can go through, and the parameters of the quantum algorithm you adjust based on the values of these vectors. And so again, we don't need to worry too much about all the details of this quantum algorithm. Everything we want to learn about the query complexity, we can learn just by looking at these vectors. So let me just give you a concrete example. So if we have AND, so we know AND, the function AND, should only give the output 1 if both inputs are 1. So we can set the target to be this vector. Set if input 1 is 1, we give it this vector. If input 2 is 1, we give it this vector. And all the other vectors we set to 0. So we see that the target is going to be in the span of a set of these vectors only when both inputs are 1. So anyway, that's just an example of a span program, but this is not an optimal span program for AND. So somehow you want to find the correct set of vectors that's going to give you an optimal quantum algorithm. So when we were originally with Bojan and Avinatan Hasidim, when we were studying these constant fault trees, we were using a span program algorithm, but it turned out obviously to not be optimal. Remember, it gave us that scaling with the depth. So I was able to adjust those original span programs and turn them kind of into new span programs that give the optimal scaling. So you can use a span program algorithm to get a constant query algorithm for any of these constant fault directories. Okay, but I find span programs to be a little bit unsatisfying because I don't find them very intuitive. So I'd like to just briefly tell you about another algorithm that is based on the Haar transform and that I think is very intuitive for anyone who's kind of familiar with quantum algorithms. So let's now assume that we have a one-fault tree where we have exactly one fault on every path. So this guy, I think, used to before not be a fault, but we've made him a fault, so that every single path from the root to the leaves now hits a fault. OK, so the first thing to notice, this is kind of like we were talking about without. When there are no faults, you have this nice alternating structure of zeros and ones. So what this means is that if you know the depth of the fault, that tells you the value of the tree. So here, because the value is zero, of the tree is zero, all of the faults occur at odd depth, because above the faults, there's no further faults, and so we just get an alternating structure. So we see, you know, here on this side, we just get 0, 1, 0, and then a set of faults. Here, we just get a single fault. So determining the value of the tree is equivalent to determining the parity of the level of the faults. OK, but how can we determine the parity of the level of the faults? If you look at the leaves descending from a single fault, so again, we're looking at this group here. As I kind of mentioned before, they break up into blocks. So the first half in this block all have value 0, and the second half all have value 1. And again, below these faults, they break into half, where the first, you know, maybe has value 1 or has value 0, and in the second half, it switches value. But what's important is that the size of these blocks tells you the height of the fault. Sorry, the size of the block tells you the height of the fault. So here, this block is size 8, so that means the fault is 3 levels above. You know, 2 to the 3 is 8, and so on. So to determine the value of the tree, we need to learn the level of the fault, which we can learn by figuring out the size of these blocks. Okay. So we can do this in a single quantum query using a quantum Haar transform. So we start, just like many quantum algorithms, in an equal superposition of all input states. And then we apply the oracle a single time. And it turns out that using the oracle a single time, you can add a phase to each of these inputs. And that phase is plus 1 if the input has value 0, and minus 1 if the input has value 1. So we see that if we kind of have states, have standard basis states going across here, we see that they get these phases. Because remember, we had these blocks, so we have a block that all have phase plus 1, then we have another block that all have phase minus 1, and so on. So the phases break up into this kind of block-like structure. OK, but it turns out that this is just an equal superposition of these Haar basis states. So Haar basis states are, I've kind of drawn them pictorially here. So a Haar basis state is a superposition of states, like this one here, where the first half in the superposition have phase plus 1, the second half have phase minus 1. Further basis states have smaller, kind of smaller numbers of states in the superposition. So here, you know, there are just a couple states in the superposition, but again, they have this block-like structure. So all you have to do is start an equal superposition, apply your oracle, then measure in this basis, and you'll just pick out precisely one of these blocks. But once you know the block, you know its size, you know, you can just read it off from whatever Haar basis state you get. And then once you know the size, you can calculate the level of the fault and the value of the tree. So so I think this Haar transform is kind of a nice, more intuitive way of understanding why, with a single query, it might be possible to evaluate a, you know, one fault NAND tree. Yeah. They're basically, they're kind of like if you take the Hadamard basis, which is kind of a whole bunch of these, but you just break it up into a single wavelet is a single Haar basis state. For me, it's much easier to understand pictorially. I mean, you can see if you take the inner product of these two, you're going to get kind of minus 1 on this superposition and plus 1 on the superposition, and so they cancel out. So they are an orthonormal basis. And we can talk later. I can dig up the actual definition. Yes?
This doesn't matter for query complexity, but is there an efficient transform or like algorithm for measuring the Haar basis?
Yeah, actually, I'm not sure about that. Someone was telling me earlier that there's not, but I'm actually not sure about that. Yes?
But in the end, the algorithm is exact in one query.
Exactly, yes.
Is it
it actually enough to just know the level, or do you also need to know one of the inputs, I mean, one of the input bits under that?
No, because I mean, the value of the actual value of the input bit, you know, it doesn't matter if the zeros are, yeah, so that doesn't matter. And in fact, you could imagine a whole, you know, there are a whole slew of problems that you could evaluate like this. I mean, maybe here what you care about is the parity of the outcome. But maybe what you care about is its value mod 3 or something, and your promise that, you know, you're going to be in a superposition of higher basis states who all have, you know, size that some, you know, that are all the same mod 3 or, you know, something like this. So this kind of generalizes to a whole series of, you know, efficient HAR algorithms and query complexity.
Yes.
So this method works whenever there's exactly one fault per branch, or it always works if it's one fault, maximally one fault?
Yeah, it works exactly if there's exactly one fault. If there's not, you know, there's a probability of error, but then yeah, I haven't quite analyzed it in that case. I mean, I think there's you can get a good algorithm using some combination of this, but then you know suddenly if there are not too many faults, then somehow the tree just alternates, right? So it becomes very simple. So
but you're up a bound plus whenever there's a bound in the number of faults per branch, right?
Right. So the span programs work. The span program algorithm works, you know, for all cases. But this was just to show to kind of give a more more natural, maybe.
The program works with one query as well, or a constant number?
So that, I believe, was a constant number. Yeah, I think it's like 2 or something for a, but I don't know. It's all asymptotically bounded, so I'm not quite sure how literally to take that. Yeah. Yes.
You're talking about a class of exact quantum algorithms with super polynomial speedup over there in classical category?
Well, this is a single query, and classically it takes log d queries, where d is the depth of the tree. So, yeah, it's.
It's a partial function. It's a partial function.
Yes, it's a little bit of, yeah, that's important that it's a partial function. Any other? Right. Okay, so I think that's everything I wanted to cover. So I've described this quantum adversary upper bound, and we've applied it to this case of these constant fault trees and seen that we can use it to prove the existence of a constant query algorithm. And then I showed you how to create, sketched how to create them using span programs, and then I gave you this HAR transform algorithm that does it exactly in the case of exactly one fault. So I think there are a lot of questions remaining. So, I mean, these constant fault trees, you know, I've tried to tell you they're not so contrived, but I mean, ultimately, I think they are a little bit of a contrived problem. So it'd be nice if we can apply this result to problems that are maybe more natural or more useful. You know, this HAR transform algorithm, it would be really nice if there are some other applications for that algorithm or for the span program algorithms. But you know, the bigger question underlying this talk is, what can we get out of this connection between the semi-definite program and quantum query complexity? You know, what other structure can we take advantage of in the semi-definite program or in other representations of algorithms that we can use to build and design better algorithms? So things, you know, like learning graphs and span programs are all a result of somehow trying to better understand this semi-definite program. So, but there's still a lot of work to be done. And the final question is, you know, it's kind of funny, this whole result that we prove the existence of an algorithm, but we don't know what it is. So I don't know if there are other examples in either classical or quantum mechanics where this happens. Well, I know of at least one in, I guess it can happen fairly frequently that in if you're designing kind of a combinatorial algorithm, you can basically probabilistically prove the existence of queries that will, you know, evaluate your algorithm, but you would need to do some kind of exhaustive search, you know, exponential search to actually find what those queries quasar that you've proved exists by some probabilistic method. But I think this is, you know, it's pretty cool to, these non-constructive proofs are kind of interesting. So I'm interested if there are other examples of that. So that's all I wanted to say. Thank you all for your attention and for coming.
We asked a lot of questions during the talk, but if we have a couple minutes for a couple quick questions.
So I wonder, is it possible to, so you basically know that the algorithm just measures in this R basis, and, but also the function is partial, it's not total. So maybe, is there any way to somehow just sort of just define the function somewhat differently on the other inputs to make sure it still works with one query exactly?
You
is
mean to both test, like have a witness that it is a valid input?
No, I mean, like I would like to have an exact one query argument for some total function. Can you somehow complete the definition of this function so that it's total but the algorithm still kind of works?
But I thought for total functions there couldn't be only polynomial speedup, right?
Yes, that's true.
Yeah,
but I guess so it would have to be constant.
So I guess what is the most natural sort of total function for which somehow you can still use this kind of value? I mean, I don't know, it's going to be really
weird. That's a really good question.
There may not exist one. It's not necessary that if you have a partial quantum algorithm for a partial function, that is a quantum algorithm for a total function which includes this partial function necessarily. Mm-hmm. In fact, in this case, it won't probably because there's a classical lower bound that shows that you need some number of queries and this thing where total functions requiring you can actually have polynomial speed up.
So I guess basically once you start to complete a function, then the best one model somehow will start to behave worse and worse.
But I mean, what does that mean polynomial? Like here, you know, one and log d are related, you know, polynomially in n, right? So.
I thought the result was that the quantum query complexity is at most.
You're right. To the power of yes. No, you're right.
Okay, so if there are no more questions, let's thank you.
One more.
In terms of these applications of these fault trees, and of these more general sort of nominally fully Boolean functions with some constraints on them about they're set by some promise. Have you thought about systems, physical systems, where things like the correlation functions of spins and the like have these types of constraints?
I've not thought about that, but if you have some ideas, I'd be happy to talk.
Sure, yeah, we can talk about it. I mean, it's just there are systems with some amounts of frustration where you can imagine that there's sort of energetic promise. The clusters beyond a certain size don't exist, but you can then ask something like, how close am I to the ground state of the system? And that's something that might correspond to this sort of Boolean check. So you're looking over different clusters of spins, but you have some constraints on the spins. They can't be all configurations, only a certain subset. I'm kind of curious if that sort of constrained spin check question is something you've looked at.
Yeah, no, I haven't, but I mean, sounds like potentially that could be related, yeah.
Okay. Now let's thank Sheldon.